Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests. In the first half, we're going to talk to Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath, and he's a cognitive neuroscientist who's written a book, Stop Talking and Start Influencing. And then in the second half, we're going to talk to Don Demure. He's an educator and spokesman for one of the oldest herbal companies in the world. And we're going to talk about herbal help for men's health. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
When someone with HIV has the virus suppressed with medication, there is virtually no chance of passing it on to sex partners, a new review concludes. The Public Health Agency of Canada pulled together studies from the last decade looking at the risk of HIV transmission among partners where one person is HIV positive and one is not. It found there were no cases of transmission when the HIV-positive partner was on drug cocktails that were keeping the virus suppressed. Suppressed means there were fewer than 200 copies of the virus per milliliter of blood. In those cases, the review found, there were no HIV transmissions even when couples did not use condoms. The results were published November 19th in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. If you're bullied by a bad boss or coworker, your heart may pay the price, new research shows. Victims of on-the-job bullying or violence faced a higher risk of heart disease and stroke, the researchers found. The new study of more than 79,000 European workers couldn't prove cause and effect, but if there is a causal link, eliminating workplace bullying would mean we could avoid 5% of all cardiovascular cases, theorized study leader Tianwei Zhu. She's a doctoral student at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. In the new study, Zhu's team tracked long-term data from more than 79,000 working adults in Denmark and Sweden, ages 18 to 65, with no prior history of heart disease. The findings were published November 18th in the European Heart Journal. If you're a pot-smoking parent and you think your kids aren't affected, think again. New research found evidence of secondhand marijuana smoke exposure in nearly half of children whose parents smoked the drug. Researcher Dr. Karen Wilson from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City said while the effects of tobacco smoke have been studied extensively, we are still learning about marijuana exposure. What we found in this study is that secondhand marijuana smoke does get into the lungs and little bodies of young children, she said in a school news release. People with peanut allergy can protect themselves from an allergic reaction by consuming a small amount of peanut powder every day, a new study suggests. The breakthrough findings mean this new treatment is ready for review by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the researchers added. In an American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology news release, study co-author Dr. Stephen Tillis said, "We're excited about the potential to help children and adolescents with peanut allergy protect themselves against accidentally eating a food with peanut in it. Our hope when we started the study was that by treating patients with the equivalent of one peanut per day, many would tolerate as much as two peanuts." The study was to be presented Sunday at the college's annual meeting in Seattle and published simultaneously in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Today we have Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath with us. He's a renowned cognitive neuroscientist with an expertise in human learning and memory. He works directly with top businesses and universities to help them elevate their approach to leadership, influence, and communication. And he's also the author of the book, Stop Talking and Start Influencing. Welcome, Jared.
Hi, how are you?
I am very well. So there's so much going on in neuroscience right now. It seems to be all the ancient wisdom is coming forward in neuroscience.
New findings.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with the cognitive neuroscientist part of your work?
Well, I was originally a teacher, and back when I was teaching, that's when the brain stuff started to really kind of take off. And so I just thought, if I go back and study the brain and psychology, I might have a better shot of teaching and influencing students. So I ended up, what was meant to be just like a little four-year step into the world has now become almost 15 years of doing this research. So I still get to do a lot of work with teachers and students, but I also work on the medical side now as well, looking at different things we can do with the brain to help patients as they progress through diseases and stuff.
Fascinating. So what are some of the things you've just been learning?
Once I moved past the straight learning, so my favorite stuff is still how do human beings learn? Memory, attention, all that really kind of fun, nuggety stuff, the stuff that when you're a student you can use, but also as adults and we get older, we can keep using. I think one of the big things I've kind of been playing with recently is with aging, So as you probably know, a big issue with aging is cognitive decline, people losing their memory, inability to think. Mm-hmm. And how do we kind of stave that off? And I think for a long time, we were playing with this concept of brain games, and if I just do a crossword every day, that'll work. And we now know that that's not really the case, that if you want to stave off cognitive decline, it looks like novelty is kind of the answer. You have to put yourself out of your comfort zone. You have to learn something new. You have to take up a sport you've never played, or learn a language or an instrument that you've never played. And it's that actual act of doing something difficult, of putting yourself in a slight stress situation, that can actually boost your memory and keep you cognitively sharp for as long as you go. So it's not just about reading books or anything. It's about doing new stuff, continuing to learn your entire life, essentially.
That's fascinating because, you know, we've always thought that we could just get up and do Sudoku or crosswords and keep doing what we've always done because it feels okay. We know how to do it. But you're saying that actually stepping out and challenging and stressing our brains creates new neural pathways?
Bingo. So that was. I think the people who originally started that research was, yeah, it was that idea that if I just keep doing a crossword again and again, is that actually going to hurt? And it turns out, yep, so long as you stay in that kind of repetition routine, that's where things really start to decline. So it's about stepping out of the routine, which is really difficult for some people in retirement, but at least we know kind of the ideas are starting to play around. How can we get people out of their comfort zone?
That's fascinating. So, and it might look like it's a lot harder on your brain to learn something new and to come out of that comfort zone. And all things are possible at all stages of life. So keep challenging yourself is what you're saying?
Exactly. For that kind of thing, that's exactly what it looks like. So we always have this decline in kind of brain density as you once you reach 65, 70. And we always just thought it was kind of biological, but we realized, no, it's in a very kind of cheap metaphor, it's similar to a muscle in that if you just kind of get into a routine, you plateau really quickly and then it becomes highly efficient. So the body just starts to deteriorate around it. So it's about as much as you might not like the feeling, putting yourself into that. And that's my favorite one is languages or instruments. If you pick up a new instrument, man, sometimes it can feel really, really rough, but that is the sign that you're keeping things fresh and alive in the brain. So kind of that, those moments, those periods of short, sweet stress where you're really working hard at something new for an hour a day, that's the stuff that keeps us fresh.
Wonderful. And Jared, what does physical exercise have to do with keeping the mind alive?
Yeah, physical exercise pumps out a bunch of really good chemicals through the body, which then feed back into the brain and kind of keep the brain from deteriorating as well. So I think it's kind of same as maybe like an old car, is the less you use it, the more it just kind of fades away. So the more exercise you can do, and it doesn't even really have to be crazy. I think for a while there, we were pushing towards the, you know, 30 to 40 minutes of high cardiovascular, high weightlifting. And although that stuff is still good, anything seems to work better than nothing. So even small walks every day, it could be enough to change the body and then feed back in to change the brain. So I think it's the same thing with diet too. It seems like just all these really small, simple things, all of that can feed back, change the chemicals in the body, change the chemicals in the brain, and that's kind of how we stay sharp.
Wonderful. Now, when we're looking at our seniors with Alzheimer's, dementia, have you learned anything new with that? Or is it once you've gotten that far, there's really just maintaining where you're at?
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are still working on treating and combating it. And people are working on it, but we're not really getting anywhere with it. The only thing we can comfortably say with those different dementias, so Alzheimer's and frontotemporal and some of these Parkinson's dementias, is that once you get it, you got it. It's mm-hmm. just going to slowly deteriorate. There's nothing we can do to stop it at this point. But what we have been working on is I don't want to say workarounds, but what you're trying to do is if you know you have it, you can kind of start to notice your own cognitive issues. So everyone has kind of subtle different ones. Some people might not be able to find words. Some people will start to forget faces. once you can kind of find your own cognitive decline pattern, then you can find ways to supplement it and work around it. So we're not staving off the disease, but we're giving you strategies to help you work better with that disease. So you can stay in work longer, you can stay in public longer, you can keep essentially living your life longer because you know how to play around every little cognitive issue that you're having. So rather than saying, hey, we're going to find a cure soon and then leaving people depressed when we don't find one, we're now working more with the, cool, you've got the disease, no problem. Let's just make a profile for you and start developing strategies to help you keep going with your life until it reaches a spot where it's too bad, and then we need to really start thinking about hospital care.
Mm-hmm. So is there any, you know, certainly diet plays a part. Are you aware of any supplements that really help keep the brain as plastic as possible?
No, you know, I think a lot of, and this is one of those really tricky fields, a lot of research keeps coming out, and there's nothing that I would hang my hat on at this point. I always say, look, there's going to be nothing bad. Unless you're taking, I don't know, some hardcore drugs or something, I don't imagine there's going to be anything wildly negative. If somebody's coming out with a supplement saying, hey, this is good for your heart, this is good for your lungs, this is good for your brain, it's probably not going to hurt. But I don't think we've found that kind of panacea yet that's going to cure all, and so long as everyone takes it, it's going to be good. So I say it's all good, but there's nothing I find that I'm willing to stand up and say, yep, we're all behind this. This is the way to go at this point.
Okay. Okay. And you're working a lot, really with educators and, helping people influence and communicate better. How do we influence people rather than just give them data?
Well, I think that's the wonderful stuff. This is where, and you can see where my, as a teacher, this stuff became really big, because when you're teaching, it's, we have this tendency of just standing up in front of people and, you know, like you said, just throwing facts at them and hoping they remember them. So some of the big things we've kind of been learning is our, in terms of, say, memory, probably the best thing you could do is recall. So we always think about, how can I put information into your head and then keep repeating it? So reread a book chapter or rewatch a lecture or just keep putting the information back in. Mm-hmm. It turns out that's not the case. If you want strong memories, you only have to put it in once. It's about bringing it out. Every time you access that memory, think about it, then that memory becomes deeper, stronger, better. So if you think about stressors or life events from our past, those things only happened once, but we talk about it again and again. We reminisce about it over the dinner table. We go online and look up information about it. All of that accessing the memory is what's making it stronger. So it's about, one of the things we've been working with is finding ways to help teachers, students, and leaders kind of implement these recall strategies into lessons, into meetings, so that people have a better shot of forming deep memories and then being able to use that information.
Okay, Jared, this is fascinating. We're going to have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about more about your recall strategies. So be right back.